Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. On the morning after Bill O'Reilly was forced out of his Fox News Channel show following revelations by the New York Times that at least five women have received payouts from O'Reilly or the company totaling $13 million in exchange for agreeing not to sue him for sexual harassment or to speak publicly about their claims. Other Fox News Channel women are now coming forward publicly since the article was published April 1st. O'Reilly continues to deny all the allegations. O'Reilly, Fox News Channel's highest-rated host, joins Roger Ailes, its longtime chairman, who was fired last summer because of his own serial sexual harassment allegations. We now see that the response of the Murdoch family was incredibly slow in both of these cases, preferring to cover up for years rather than hold their leading men responsible for their actions that were bad enough to pay payouts of in O'Reilly's case. Ultimately, when word got out and sponsors pulled their ads by the score, the Murdochs acted in their self-interest to save their brand. The president of the United States apparently feels no such pressure on his brand. It's like not releasing his tax returns. After co-starring in the Access Hollywood tape, Billy Bush got fired, Trump got 300 electoral votes. Case closed, as far as he's concerned. So when word got out about O'Reilly, Trump said, "I don't think Bill did anything wrong. He's a good person."
"I think he's a person I know well. He's a good person. I think he may, you know, I think he shouldn't have settled. Mm-hmm. Personally, mm-hmm. I think he shouldn't have settled."
"How come?"
"Because you should have taken it all the way. No, I know Bill. Bill's a good person. I don't think Bill would do anything wrong."
Trump from the New York Times podcast, The Daily, without providing evidence, the president of the United States declared all those women liars in that statement on April 5th. The new Quinnipiac poll released yesterday shows Trump's popularity has increased since then, probably because he bombed Syria. No apparent impact of his statements about O'Reilly on his brand. We will talk later in the show about how women in the workplace can protect yourselves against sexual harassment in the workplace, despite the cover-up culture, and how employers, large and small, can best handle allegations when they're clear-cut or in shades of gray. But first, on Tuesday, Trump went to Kenosha, Wisconsin, to announce an executive order on hiring American and buying American. And he complained about how hard it is to get out of NAFTA.
"And we're going to do some things. And we have all sorts of rules and regulations that are horrendous. Like, we wanted started to negotiate with Mexico immediately. And we have these provisions where you have to wait long periods of time. You have to notify Congress. And after you notify Congress, you have to get certified. And then you can't speak to them for 100 days. The whole thing is ridiculous. NAFTA has been very, very bad for our country. It's been very, very bad for our companies and for our workers. And we're going to make some very big changes, or we are going to get rid of NAFTA for once and for all."
Trump Tuesday in Kenosha, Wisconsin. That same night on our national call-in show, Indivisible, I interviewed Michael Moore, who, having grown up in Flint, was no stranger to places where GM plants have been shutting down. And he said this.
"Kenosha is the Flint of Wisconsin. Kenosha, Janesville, that area. It's offensive to me to see him there because he is essentially using very desperate working class people as his props."
Wisconsin was so central to Trump's upset of Hillary Clinton. And with me now is Washington Post reporter Amy Goldstein, who has a new book called Janesville, An American Story. It's about families and individuals in Janesville, Wisconsin, in the years since the biggest employer in town, a General Motors plant, shut down in 2008. Janesville is also House Speaker Paul Ryan's district. It also helped Trump get elected, mostly because of a much lower Democratic turnout for Clinton than Obama had had in his elections. With me now, again, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Amy Goldstein from The Washington Post. These days, she's largely covering health care, including the repeal and replace Obamacare efforts. Her book, again, is Janesville, An American Story. Amy, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You heard Trump. You heard Michael Moore. How would you begin to put Janesville in context for the rest of the nation?
Well, it was interesting that President Trump chose to go to Kenosha, and he spoke, as you may know, at a toolmaking plant that's been doing pretty well. But there are other companies in that same congressional district that Paul Ryan represents that have not been doing well at all. And the book that I just wrote about, the place I just wrote about, was the oldest operating General Motors assembly plant in the country until it shut down at the end of 2008. And this was a plant that had started making tractors in 1919 and began turning out Chevys in 1923. So it had this long history in town in which generations of people living in Janesville, Wisconsin, understood that these were the best working class jobs. When the plant closed, GM was paying the UAW workers there $28 an hour. That's a big loss.
Where are those cars made now, whatever cars were being made at the end?
Well, the cars that were being made at the end, and this was partly why this plant was closed, were full-size SUVs. They were Tahoes. And if you think about what was happening with the economy and with gas prices during the Great Recession, gas prices were over $4 a gallon that summer. And people weren't ordering these cars, these big SUVs. So there were two plants that were making them, the Janesville plant, which had been around for eons, and a somewhat newer plant in Arlington, Texas. And when the demand shrank so much, the Arlington plant kept making the SUVs and the Janesville plant was closed.
And you frame part of this story around what you call the two Janesvilles since the plant closed, separated by political outlook and economic circumstance. And I guess it's Janesville, but it's also America writ small. How would you compare the two Janesvilles?
Well, Janesville is a pretty resilient, resourceful community. It had a very proud industrial history. And even when this happened, you know, people didn't just lie down and take it. People have been trying very hard to rebuild their lives and their communities. Janesville also had been a pretty cohesive place. It's not to say that there weren't political differences among people or class differences, but it wasn't a very polarized place. And what I saw with his research was that over a period of years, as you say, is kind of a metaphor, a microcosm of what was happening nationally, the distinctions grew wider. And one of the first times that I think that began to really emerge was a year after the plant closed, when there had been a big effort by the state of Wisconsin, the people of Janesville, and the people of its county, Rock County, to try to persuade General Motors to reopen the plant, to give the plant a new subcompact to manufacture that GM was starting up. And they lost. And when that decision was made, it was sort of a second blow to this community. And the responses were really different. Many of the former GM workers or people who had worked at a lot of local suppliers that had done the work for the plant, and they had also lost their jobs, those working class people basically said, you know, you just wait. This plant is eventually going to open up. We've been a good plant. We've made good products. We're well-regarded in the GM firmament. It's just a matter of time. But on the other hand, people like Paul Ryan and the business leadership of the community said, look, this isn't going to happen. It's time to move on. Let's try to get rid of the GM ownership of that dead property and find something else we can use it for. That was a big schism that began to open up at that point in town.
By the way, is almost everyone in both Janesvilles white, or is this also a story of the intersection of race and class?
That's a good question. Janesville is predominantly white. It's not exclusively white, but it's predominantly white. But the next town to the south, Beloit, Wisconsin, which is right on the Illinois line, is much more racially diverse. And there are people in Beloit who have been working in Janesville. So this is, you know, a set of job losses that affected people of different races and ethnic groups.
You describe through Janesville what has happened to so much of middle class or formerly middle class America. The unemployment rate there is low, like the rest of the country, around 4%. But wages have fallen compared to before. Can you flesh that out a little? Fallen how much and with what effects on people's lives and hopes? You tell so many individual stories in the book.
Well, one of the things that I tend to say when people say, so how is Janesville doing now, is it depends on how you measure it. If you look purely at the unemployment rate, it's come down a lot, as you say. Unemployment in Rock County, Janesville's county, had soared to more than 13% early in 2009, a few months after the assembly plant closed and all these supplier company jobs went away as well. And it's now down to just under 5%. But that masks some profound changes in the nature of work that is available in this part of Wisconsin. There really aren't $28 manufacturing jobs anywhere in sight. People have found jobs, but they're not necessarily good jobs. They're not necessarily jobs with good benefits. Some people are working two jobs. You know, Rock County and Janesville have really worked hard to try to attract new business to town. I mean, they've worked really hard at this. And they've had a certain degree of success, but let me give you one example. One of the soon-to-arrive companies that Janesville's proud of attracting is Dollar General, which is going to be opening up a distribution center in town. And it's bringing about 300 jobs at the outset, maybe a little bit more eventually. Now, that compares to 3,000 people who lost jobs just at General Motors. And in the heyday of this assembly plant in the 1970s, 7,100 jobs. So bringing 300 jobs to town is a big deal, but it's not what it was. And in terms of pay, these Dollar General jobs, as I understand, are going to be offering perhaps $15, $16 an hour compared to $28 wages at GM. But even though the wages are going to be so much less, when Dollar General had a job fair last fall, 3,000 people turned out for 300 or so jobs. And that, to me, says something about, you know, these look like good jobs compared to what people were working at the moment.
There's a day you write about in 2015 when GM finally announces that the plant would never reopen. And it comes just as the U.S. auto industry was reaching record sales. And the next day, Paul Ryan is sworn in as Speaker of the House. The U.S. auto industry reached record sales in 2015?
It's reached record sales more recently than 2015, but, you know, even then the sales were, you know, on their way back up. And that's kind of the duality that is so striking, both in Janesville and, as you were saying, nationally. You know, more than one thing is true at once. So this assembly plant in Janesville had for several years been the only plant in the whole GM firmament that was in this limbo status called standby. And that meant that it wasn't making anything. It was inert. But it was still available in case the demand for GM products grew so much that GM might want another facility. So that gave people in town, like I said, that gave people in town for years hope that eventually this plant would reopen. But in the most recent contract between the United Auto Workers and General Motors, that limbo standby status was removed, and the plant was permanently closed.
So why not reopen the plant that was in limbo for 7 years if sales were peaking rather than abandon the city?
Well, GM had already, you use the word lexicon, the lexicon of abandoned, had already gotten out of the city. This plant was closed. And every time an auto plant starts manufacturing something new, it requires, and this is for any automaker, it requires a huge investment to retool the plant. I write about Janesville. I'm not writing a tale of GM's internal, you know, thinking about its decisions in terms of, you know, how it's going to accommodate the increasing sales. But it would have taken a lot to get that plant back up. What's happened now with the property, and it's a huge property. I mean, this was a 4.8 million square foot plant, I mean, the size of 10 football fields. It was a big, big piece of property around that big plant. The city of Janesville is trying to find a new buyer for that property. And part of what's happening to get ready is there's some environmental cleanup going on. So General Motors, if it had come back to Janesville, would have had to do that as well.
My guest is Washington Post correspondent Amy Goldstein. Her new book is Janesville, An American Story. We're going to bring it up to the politics of today and right now, and we invite your phone calls. Anybody listening who happens to be from the Janesville area or the Kenosha area where the president spoke not that far away. Recently, you heard Michael Moore tie them together in the clip we played the other day, in the clip we played a few minutes ago from our interview the other day. And anything you want to say about that or the politics of working class America, what, 91 days now into the presidency of Donald Trump? There don't seem to be many people in the polls in that demographic who are feeling that much buyer's remorse. What about you? What about people you know out in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or Michigan, those three crucial surprise Trump voting states? Or anything you want to say or ask Amy Goldstein from The Washington Post. Again, her book, Janesville, An American Story, but it's really about so many places in so many parts of the country. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So Janesville voted 52% for Clinton, but it had voted 60% for Obama. What happened?
Well, Janesville is an old UAW town. It's very Democratic. And it's still got kind of a union identity, even though most of its union jobs have gone away. So it's been a place that, you know, it's an interesting kind of duality because Paul Ryan, you know, one of the leading conservatives in Congress, even before he ascended to House Speaker, is from there, and he's been representing this community since he was 28 years old. But he's never really been in sync with the prevailing kind of values politically of his most immediate constituency. I mean, there are other parts of his district that are more Republican that make his a pretty safe seat. So as you say, in 2012, 62% of the people in Rock County voted for Barack Obama for re-election. And this year it was 52%, as you say, for Hillary Clinton. And when I looked at the raw numbers, what struck me was that there hadn't been this conversion of Democratic votes to Republican votes. The number of Republican votes this time was almost exactly what it was four years ago. But there had been a real drop-off in Democratic voting turnout this time. So that's what happened.
You write about the importance of government programs like food stamps. Wisconsin calls it food share, and government-subsidized job retraining programs in Janesville after General Motors left. What were some of the most important ones of these?
Well, job training was something I was very interested in because it seemed to me that if you think about the economic policies that Republicans and Democrats espouse, there was obviously little intersection to those two lists, and job training is one of the few economic policies in which the political parties tend to agree. So I really wanted to look at how effective this was in the context of this one bruised community that had lost so much of its work. And a lot of people went back to school. Janesville has a small technical college called Black Hawk Technical College that is designed almost exclusively to do the kind of vocational training that job retraining is all about. And in the first couple of years after so many jobs went away, roughly 2,000 displaced workers, most of them former factory workers, descended on this little college. And the college actually responded, I thought, in very shrewd, sophisticated ways. I mean, they did the things that the federal government says colleges like this should do. I mean, they met with the remaining local businesses to try to get a feel for what were the fields that perhaps people should study in order to find a job or have a chance of finding a job at the other end of their schooling. When they discovered that many of the factory workers coming back to school who had been perfectly good at their old jobs weren't that good at using computers, in some cases didn't even know how to turn on a computer. And this wasn't part of their work lives before. Black Hawk Tech started a computer boot camp very quickly. It started study skill programs for people who were, you know, in some cases, half a lifetime away from having been in school the last time and were very nervous about being students. They were traumatized by their loss of a job. They were worried about how they were going to have dinner for their family. I mean, this was a hard thing to go back to school for people who were suddenly, you know, knocked out of their jobs, the jobs that they had thought they would have until they retired with a pension.
When I hear Paul...
So the school did...
Go ahead. So the school did...
I'm sorry. So I was going to say, the school did very good work, but that doesn't mean that the outcomes were all that good. I mean, some people retrained finished their programs and found jobs in their field. Many did not.
When I hear Paul Ryan, who represents the district, he sounds like the biggest opponent in the world of such programs and blames the people who are on them for lack of individual responsibility. Here is a one-minute clip of, I guess, a younger Congressman Ryan. I'm not sure exactly what year this is from, on why Ryan is an acolyte of the radical individualist writer Ayn Rand.
You know, it doesn't surprise me that sales of The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged have surged lately with the Obama administration coming in. Because it's that kind of thinking, that kind of writing that is sorely needed right now. And I think a lot of people would observe that we are right now living in an Ayn Rand novel, metaphorically speaking. But more to the point is this. The issue that is under assault, the attack on democratic capitalism, on individualism and freedom in America, is an attack on the moral foundation of America. And Ayn Rand, more than anyone else, did a fantastic job of explaining the morality of capitalism, the morality of individualism. And this, to me, is what matters most. It is not enough to say that President Obama's taxes are too big or the health care plan doesn't work for this or that policy reason. It is the morality of what is occurring right now and how it offends the morality of individuals working toward their own free will to produce, to achieve, to succeed, that is under attack. And it is that what I think Ayn Rand would be commenting on, which we need that kind of comment more and more than ever.
So that was Paul Ryan sometime in the first Obama term. Was Paul Ryan not moved by the decline in incomes of the people of his hometown who were working just as hard as before with 4% unemployment, but with lower wages, as you described, that he could place so much on personal individual responsibility?
Well, I've interviewed Paul Ryan a few times, long interviews for this book. And by the time I spoke with him, he had become, in an interesting way, kind of the conservative in Congress who was speaking to the issue of poverty. He wrote a book called The American Way, and his formulation is that, yes, there is a matter of individual responsibility, but he also espouses this idea that between the individual and the government, there should be a layer of help arising from communities. There should be philanthropy and charity and benevolence towards one's neighbors. And that's his idea about how to sort of diminish government people's reliance on government assistance when they hit hard times. Now, there are nonprofits in Janesville that have tried very hard. I spent a fair amount of time at some of them, a little health clinic called HealthNet downtown, or a food pantry called Echo, that's been around since the 1960s, since the war on poverty of the 1960s. Those places have been raising money as hard as they can, but the need has gotten so much greater that, there's a gap between the capacity and the need. Now, I also know that, you can dislike Paul Ryan's politics or his, who he holds out as his ideological role models, but I know that he has friends from high school or the parents of friends from high school who are at the assembly plant who've lost their jobs. He has neighbors who've been affected by this. So, whether or not you like his the remedies that he espouses, I have no reason to think that he isn't aware of what's been happening around him in his hometown.
But what would Paul Ryan's budget roadmaps have done to things like the technical college that was retraining so many people from the GM plant in Janesville, Wisconsin?
Yeah, so the bigger issue, I think, among people who are kind of resentful of Ryan's thinking back in his hometown is that he has had a long-standing opposition to earmarks. Under other circumstances with different representation in Congress, when a lot of jobs went away, the congressional representative might have tried to, grab things from the federal budget to help their hometown. And that was never something that Ryan believed that he should do. And again, rightly or wrongly, he's obviously, when the plant shut down, he was quite involved in about a year-long effort to try to get it to either stay open or, once it closed, reopen. He was part of a delegation that went to Detroit to meet with the leadership of General Motors to present what was at the time the largest package of economic incentives that Wisconsin had ever opened, which the state of Wisconsin, the city of Janesville, hoped would attract a new product to this closed assembly plant. So he was part of that effort. But over time, I mean, I think that he became more involved in his Washington world. And, you know, what he would say, again, like it or not, is if you get the macroeconomics right, that will improve the economy in a way that will spur job creation. I mean, that's a conservative formulation, and it's what he's been aiming for.
Lynn in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Amy Goldstein from The Washington Post. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I was surprised that you seemed puzzled by, you know, Paul Ryan's fondness for Ayn Rand. I mean, I'm not the biggest Ayn Rand reader myself because I simply don't, it's a matter of prose, I'm not that fond of it.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised by it. I've known it for a long time, but I was bringing it in as relevant to, I think, Amy's book. But go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think all he's trying to do is to explain that, you know, America is really based on a civil rights version of individualism, which Ayn Rand, you know, some people say she's radical. She, you know, it's a kind of, she's more of a polemical statement maker. And really what conservative Republicans are trying to do here is correct what they regard as bad law. For instance, NAFTA was too interfering with the economy. You know, their concept is that economics works from the bottom up, not from the top down. And we have a long historical precedent of top-down, very controlling laws. And it's a kind of an inheritance from the FDR era. And so that's really where Republicans are coming from. They're trying to correct bad law. That's why Trump is anti-NAFTA. He says, at this point, we have to change that. You know, we're driving industries out of the country. We don't want to be consciously doing that. And, you know, NAFTA, of course, was originally promoted by a lot of Republicans who were, you know, sort of interested in globalization. Everybody was interested in globalization.
Right.
And obviously, we have to adjust to it. But
and I don't want to conflate the two things. I don't know how Ayn Rand would have felt about NAFTA in particular. She may have supported it from a free market philosophy, a philosophical standpoint, because, you know, basically these free trade agreements are for fewer tariffs, let the market decide what commodities get sold at what prices across national borders. But, of course, Democrats would have a very different view of Ayn Rand's, of laws that flow from Ayn Rand's philosophy than just correcting bad law, that Paul Ryan and other people who subscribe to her philosophy see the world as makers and takers, and if people aren't making it in the marketplace, it's because they don't have enough individual responsibility and the taxpayers are being gotten over on by the poorer people. So I don't think it's as simple as you put it. But, Lynn, I appreciate that framing. Amy, what about NAFTA? You think the people of Janesville are very anti-NAFTA? And you heard the clip we played at the beginning of Trump in Kenosha this week saying how difficult it is to undo NAFTA. And, you know, I wonder if there's a lot of resentment there with the GM plant closing over that.
So let me reframe the question a little bit, if you don't mind.
Please.
You know, I did this book in a climate in which, you know, I began this work in 2011. So the Great Recession was still pretty fresh. And there was a lot of debate going on of the kind that we've just had the last couple of minutes about what were the correct economic policies, what was useful, what was not useful, whose ideas should one adhere to or try to move in the direction of. And my feeling was that, okay, that was all going on, but there wasn't really a lot of understanding, at least I didn't see a lot of writing, that was focused on what were the ground level experiences of people who lost work. What does losing work mean to an individual? What does it mean to a perfectly ordinary, fairly cohesive community? So I wanted to kind of cut through all of that ideological debate and just look at the ground level reality of what does it do to a family when the work vanishes? I mean, that was my purpose.
Well, how much do the Trump voters in Janesville blame immigrants more than Wall Street, more than an economy that's rigged to enrich the 1% while they work for $15 an hour instead of their previous 30, as you were describing. How does it divide?
Well, I mean, Janesville is like any place. You can find people of political stripes that vary. You know, as I said a moment ago, this is a blue place. Rock County is a blue place. It's voted against Scott Walker every time, including in the 2012 recall election, in which Walker, who had become, you know, a highly polarizing figure, primarily over his anti-union positions, but also because of his kind of budget conservatism. Rock County was one of a small minority of counties that voted for the recall. That doesn't mean that everybody is Democratic. And there's the same mix of views you would find in any other community. But one of the things that really strikes me, though, through this work that I have done, is that, yes, people have different policy beliefs. But if you say, you know, who do people blame for what happened, for this job loss? And was it NAFTA or was it GM being bad or what was going on? You know, I've really come to believe that when jobs go away for people, it feels very personal. And there's a whole research literature that talks about this, how losing a job is a very psychologically, in addition to economically, damaging experience for somebody. And I found that even in a community such as Janesville, Wisconsin, in which thousands of jobs were going away all at once, people and families take it to heart. You wonder, why did I lose this work? Why can't I readily find another job? If I were just good enough, I should be finding another job, no matter the scarcity of jobs in the community. And that was the kind of reaction that most interested me through the interviewing that I did.
But the intersection with that and the intersection between that and politics, as I think you referenced it before, is that more Democrats stayed home in the 2016 elections than before the plant closed, but the same number of Republicans came out.
So that's right. I mean, that's you know, statistically what happened in the 2016 presidential elections. You know, I know people in town who are active Republicans. I know people in town who are active Democrats. You know, I don't want to sound corny about this, but Janesville's kind of a microcosm of America. There are people who believe everything. You know, I guess what I've come to think is that, you know, in this country, obviously, Trump was elected in part by the support of people who have been working class, still are working class, if they're lucky enough to still have their jobs, and have become disaffected, disenchanted with government policies, feeling as if they're not being useful enough to them personally. Janesville is not a Trump voting place, but I think that the kinds of economic experiences and the effects that those have had on families and on the community are the same kind of experiences that in less Democratic places motivated people to vote for now President Trump.
Pulitzer Prize winning Washington Post correspondent Amy Goldstein, her new book, Janesville, An American Story. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we will meet Bob Ganji, running for mayor in the Democratic primary against Mayor de Blasio, if he can get on the ballot. Stay with us.